Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today we're dishing out what we're calling culinary classics. In other words, we're going to be revisiting some of the stories we've done about the diverse and delicious gastronomic scene here in the nation's capital. We'll head to D.C.'s Capitol Hill neighborhood to sample what may be the world's most gourmet Pop-Tarts, and we'll visit the Korean Cultural Center to learn how to make the longtime staple kimchi. Plus, we'll ride along with some Chesapeake Bay watermen as they haul those iconic blue crabs out of the water. And we'll take a tour down a rather mouth-watering memory lane and visit some long-gone Washington restaurants. But first, we're going to turn up the heat and taste it, too.
One of my cooks in the kitchen took a little bite off the tip of one. She goes, "This is nothing." I'm like, "Oh, yeah?" She goes, "Yeah." And so she took another bite. And she's sweating, and her eyes are all watered up, and nose is running, and it's like, oh, they are hot.
This is Tom Elder.
I'm the executive chef of Hearth Restaurant here at the Hilton McLean in Tyson's Corner.
He helped open Hearth just a few months ago, and that culinary firecracker his cook consumed was actually from the chef's organic garden behind the hotel, where you'll find tomatoes, raspberries, herbs, different kinds of mint.
And how about these peppers? Where are
and
the peppers?
The last but not least are our hot peppers. And if you can see, we have little signs out here.
It says caution.
Yeah, we have caution. If you get up close, you can read them, but it's like, you know, only the chef should touch these peppers.
Because, as the signs also indicate,
all of the peppers planted in our garden have the potential to cause pain and or discomfort upon contact.
Right. You gotta be careful.
And here's why. See, you measure the hotness of peppers using the Scoville scale, named for American pharmacist Wilbur Scoville. The more Scoville units something has, the more heat it packs. And going by that Scoville scale,
I'd say we have, for sure, six of the hottest peppers in the world out here.
Including the very hottest pepper, i.e. the one that made Chef Elder's cook totally freak out, the ghost chili.
When we first started reading up on the ghost chili, they had articles out and they said, the heat of the ghost chili is similar to drinking battery acid with shards of glass. Like, that's a descriptive that we had. It's like, what?
Okay, yeah, that does sound rather dramatic. But here's the thing. If you measure the ghost chili on the Scoville scale,
it registers right around 1 million Scoville units.
And just to give you an idea of what that means,
a jalapeno is right around 4,500 Scoville units.
So, there you go. Chef Elder's other hot peppers include, and you gotta love some of these names, Trinidad Scorpions and Devil's Tongues,
which are right around 800,000.
Bishop's Crowns,
which are right around 600,000 to 700,000.
Then you have the Pepin.
It's like a white little cherry pepper, but it's registering somewhere around 600,000.
And several types of habaneros,
which are right around 400,000 to 600,000, somewhere around in there.
At Hearth, Chef Elder peppers various menu items with peppers, from soups to ketchup to a new work in progress.
We're developing our hot pepper marmalade,
which includes another ingredient the chef doesn't exactly grow on the premises, though he does cultivate it, just 20 yards from the garden, actually, up on the roof, with a little help from these guys. Honeybees.
Oh my, like thousands of bees.
Each hive will average anywhere from 10 to 30,000 bees. So literally, I could have 120,000 bees up here right now, on the low end, and then up to 200,000 bees, just out of four hives.
And when it comes to making honey in those four hives?
Bees produce the most honey and are the most active the hotter the weather is.
So talk about feeling the heat. During a sweltering summer like this one, Chef Elder's bees have been going like gangbusters.
My friend out in California calls me, and he gets mad because he sees we have these 90, 100-degree days, and he's like, "You're making honey. I am jealous. I can't believe it."
Now, of course, bees make honey from nectar, which they collect as they pollinate flowers. And in the case of the bees up here on the roof,
would these bees pollinate your pepper plants?
Absolutely.
So you have yet another connection between Chef Elder's heat-loving bees and heat-packing peppers. The bees pollinate the peppers to make honey. You combine the peppers and honey to make that hot pepper marmalade. And what's more...
Okay, let's go ahead and get a glass of milk, and we'll get some bread. We can do some honey. We'll get some honey.
The honey acts as an excellent chaser.
The heat busters, we call them.
When you're about to taste...
You ready for that?
Okay.
The hottest pepper in the world.
Don't get too nervous.
See, Chef Elder makes this ghost chili paste.
Just a tiny little dab.
No, you want a big chunk, right?
I want...
So I'm about to find out.
I want to live to actually hear this story on the air.
Exactly what 1 million Scoville units feel like.
Okay, down the hatch.
To be honest, not much happens after the first bite.
I'm not feeling the battery acid or the shards of glass.
I gave you a little tiny taste to get you going on this.
But after the second?
And then see how it's a little bit hard to breathe?
It is a little bit hard to breathe.
It isn't so much battery acid and glass as just plain fire.
It's this whole heat all over you. It's not the kind of heat that you expect, but it continues to build. It doesn't go away.
Though, admittedly, the honey does help.
Oh, that's beautiful.
See how that's real honey.
As do the bread and milk.
Oh, that's the perfect way to end this. The cold milk.
All right.
Executive chef Tom Elder says his hot peppers have been a hit at Hearth, especially among people who crave the endorphin rush brought on by super spice, including the chef himself. Whereas I taste two dabs of ghost chili paste, he downs two big clumps.
You see me? I'm sweating.
You're sweating.
There's nothing I can do about it. It just happened.
And this hot cooking, honey making heat seeker wouldn't have it any other way. To see pictures of executive chef Tom Elder's hot pepper garden, and to see photos of both of us wearing those big spaceman bee suits and collecting honey up on the roof, visit our website, metroconnection.org. With the whole hot and spicy theme for a moment, let's talk kimchi. The Korean staple has a long pedigree, dating all the way back to the 7th century, if not earlier. Before freezers, before hydroponic vegetable gardens, kimchi made it possible to preserve vegetables and all their nutrients well into the winter months. Emily Friedman visited the Korean Cultural Center in Northwest D.C. to learn how kimchi is made and what kind of place it holds in Korean culture.
Kimchi may be one of the world's most versatile foods.
I was actually making omelets for my colleagues, and they're like, oh, you know what would be good with this? Some kimchi. And, you know, it goes with a lot of things.
That's Adam Mojahowicz.
Not a Korean name, a Polish name. I'm part of the local staff here at the Korean Cultural Center.
He says, when it comes to kimchi, there's a very common narrative. It starts when you try kimchi for the first time. You like it, you try it again, and pretty soon, it's all kimchi all the time.
When you're having like a hamburger and you get a craving for kimchi, you know you've crossed over to the kimchi side.
Now, in South Korea, just about everyone lives on the kimchi side.
Kimchi is our life. That's how serious we are.
Young Lee has worked as a chef in the U.S. for more than 30 years. Most Koreans, she says, eat kimchi at every meal. It's common for Korean families to have a whole extra refrigerator just for kimchi. And for kimchi lovers, the process behind the dish is often a mystery. So I asked Chef Lee to reveal how she makes her signature cabbage, or pechu kimchi. She starts with cabbage, though not the kind that looks like a bowling ball. She likes Chinese, or Napa cabbage, which has longer leaves.
Napa cabbage has a more crunch.
Earlier in the day, she had sliced each cabbage in half and sprinkled it with lots of salt. This is how the cabbage starts to pickle. Now, a few hours later, it's ready for the next step. Chef Lee combines red pepper paste, turnips, salt, garlic, fish sauce, and green onion to create a bright red paste. That's called the stuffing. Then, one by one, she coats each leaf of the cabbage with the stuffing.
This is the motion I put it, but don't put too much stuffing because it makes it later does not really look nice.
The final step is rolling up each cabbage, using the big outer leaves to keep in the stuffing. Then she packs them into a clay jar where the cabbage sits and ferments for a few hours, a few days, even a few months. But you can also taste the kimchi right away, which I did.
That's very good.
Cabbage kimchi is the most ubiquitous of all kimchis, but according to Adam Wojahowicz, it's just one recipe out of hundreds, maybe thousands.
So you've got all these different kinds of vegetables that you can make into kimchi. You can have cucumber kimchi, you can have cabbage kimchi, radish kimchi, onion kimchi.
Oisobegi, chonggak kimchi, every kimchi has their own way to express themselves.
And if you go to a Korean restaurant, it's likely your table will be covered in kimchi.
Basically, Koreans don't like to see the table is the way that I sum it up. The more dishes, the better.
Promoting kimchi is part of South Korea's official state policy. But even without that mandate, Wojahowicz says Koreans around the world would still put in the effort. First of all, they like to eat it. And secondly, it's a constant link to Korean culture.
There's a lot of different elements and there's a lot of history that just goes into this one little side dish. So I guess calling it a side dish might be a little misleading. In a lot of ways, it's kind of the highlight because that's where all the flavor is. And that's the thing that people kind of crave. It's really, you know, a whole genre in itself.
A genre that's about preserving not just cabbage or cucumber, but the culinary history of an entire nation. I'm Emily Friedman.
And if you're suddenly jonesing for some pickled cabbage on your burger, or on anything else for that matter, you can find Chef Lee's kimchi recipe on our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, we dig into our region's gastronomic roots and remember the dining establishments that have long since disappeared.
You ever go to Wiley's? They had the wash tub. It must have been 60 scoops of ice cream and whipped cream.
Plus, we find out how people feed themselves when they live in a food desert.
I will just eat whatever it is that I have in the house. So if that's just, you know, canned beans and a hot dog, that's fine. I mean, I'm not starving, but it would be better to have, you know, all of the food groups that are necessary to be more healthy.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today we're spooning out a heapin' helpin' of culinary classics. Some of our favorite stories about, you guessed it, food. In just a bit, we'll focus on the roadblocks to eating well. We'll hear about an insect that's been more than just a nuisance to local farmers. And we'll find out why it can be so hard to get fresh produce to the people who need it, whether they live in so-called food deserts or attend the district's public schools. But first, we're going to dig into some gustatory history and hear about restaurants that might ring a few bells if you happened to live in the Washington region, say, 50 or 60 years ago.
Go to Pop's Pizza right up here off of University. That was the best pizza.
I have a different opinion. I always thought Gusty's was the best pizza.
But they had a sweeter sauce. And were you here when the Polar Bear Custard was here on Georgia Avenue?
Yes.
And in Silver.
And
find out how to make polar bear custard again.
That's Sheila Kaufman, a D.C. native who's just a wee bit into food.
I'm the author of 26 cookbooks. I'm a cooking instructor, food editor, and a culinary lecturer, just eating my way through life.
And Ramon Zender, a longtime Washingtonian who helps run Blair Mansion.
My family's restaurant since 1959, but we go all the way back to Gusty's restaurant back in 1949.
I sat down with Sheila and Ramon at Blair Mansion in Silver Spring, Maryland.
I used to come here 40 and 50 years ago.
So did I. Still do.
To hear about the local food scene when they were growing up.
You had French, you had Italian, Chinese.
Steakhouses like
Blackie's.
Blackie's House.
Like Blackie House of Beef.
And cafeteria, Shoals Cafeteria downtown.
Blackie's and Shoals are, of course, gone. But these days, the district boasts more than 2,000 eateries of all culinary stripes. So both Sheila and Ramon agree we've come a long way.
You didn't have the varieties of food that you can go out and eat at. It's unbelievable. It's wonderful.
There's a country, there's a restaurant. That's how I feel about what's happened.
Sheila, who's also a food historian of sorts and helped found the Culinary Historians of Washington, or I love this,
Chow,
says this variety came with the arrival of more immigrants.
You had the Russians, Vietnamese, huge Indian communities. Then you began to see the Ethiopians. So none
Hispanics.
Of this, yes, none of this was here.
And as a pro in the restaurant biz, Ramon Zender says another reason D.C.'s become this diverse dining destination is plain and simple. More of us are going out for dinner.
The discussion was, how can we get people to go out to eat? And just about every restaurant except for Chinese was closed on Monday.
Because after all, Monday was considered the slowest day of the week. But now, of course, all sorts of restaurants are open on Mondays. And the dining scene here is always changing, which Sheila and Ramon say is good. Though there are still plenty of things they miss from the early days, whether it's strawberry shortcake from the Blue Mirror.
The coconut cake from Paul Young's.
Danny's Bakery on Grub Road.
With the best brand muffins and the best glazed donuts.
Not to mention that polar bear custard.
Chocolate vanilla. I tell people I was born a sugar addict and a chocoholic.
For Ramon, it's the more savory things he misses, like Italian food at the Roma.
With its back garden that you used to be able to sit back.
Bish Thompson's super fresh seafood.
You know, you felt like they just brought the boat up behind the restaurant.
And the sliders, or belly bombers, at Little Tavern.
After a night out, you really didn't want to go home quite yet. You know, you had a date, maybe you wanted to spend a little more time. You could always go to the Club LT.
But he also says the beauty of these memories is, well, in a way, they never disappear.
You know how you taste something and it brings back a memory, or smell something and you remember it, you know?
Ramon Zender and Sheila Kaufman both say every now and again they'll taste something reminiscent of an old favorite. It's just peppered and spiced with a new modern twist. So in a way, it's like having your cake, Paul Young's coconut or otherwise, and eating it too.
I've been leaving on my things, so in the morning when the morning bird sings, there's still dinner on my dinner jacket till the dinner bell rings.
We turn now from the history of eating in the Washington region to the future. Farmers here have been dealing with a fairly new challenge that makes them worry about the future. Stink bugs. If you haven't seen them crawling around the cracks and crevices of your home, they look kind of like, I don't know, little brown shields. Yeah. Totally gross, I know. And these little guys are resistant to pesticides, so they can wreak some serious havoc on certain kinds of crops. Stink bugs were somehow introduced into Allentown, Pennsylvania in the 1990s, and they've been spreading ever since. As environment reporter Sabri Benashour tells us, scientists are experimenting to see if they can defeat the stink bug with its natural predator, a parasitic Asian wasp.
By now, it almost seems like everyone in the D.C. region has had firsthand experience with the brown,
everywhere,
marmorated,
in the couch and clothing,
stink bug.
It was all black, all my walls. It was full last year.
That's Marianne Burkhart, Charles Black, and Fabi Moradian. The shield-shaped insects were introduced from Asia and descended on the region with the fury of a plague last year. If you bother or crush them, the bugs smell like cilantro and burning rubber. But for Bob Black, they're more than just a nuisance.
This thing is really going to put a big chapter in my book of life. I've never had anything affect me like this.
Black runs Catoctin Mountain Orchard in Thurmont, Maryland, where his family grows everything.
Plums, tomatoes, pears.
The apricot blossoms are just starting to come out, and Black is starting to worry. Just like many other farmers across the region, Black saw his crops decimated by marmorated stink bugs. With their long, needle-like mouthpieces, the insects pierce the flesh of fruits and vegetables and leave them bruised and disfigured.
One of my late varieties, Pink Lady, which a lot of people like, that's the latest apple, we had up to 50% damage on that. I can handle a few percent, but, you know, gets up to 25 to 50%. That's pretty devastating for me.
And as Black discovered, his usual pesticides didn't really do much.
This one can actually play in it and eat it, and it won't even kill it. That's how tough this insect is.
And this year will probably be worse.
We're going to hear a collective wail up and down the East Coast and in the metropolitan area as hordes of these things come out of people's attics and try to find their way back outdoors.
Mike Raup is an entomologist at the University of Maryland. He says the population has grown exponentially, and he says the bugs are moving outward from the epicenter of Allentown, Pennsylvania.
And they've now found in more than 30 states, as far west as Washington and California, as far south as Florida they've been detected, but right here in the mid-Atlantic region, this is ground zero for the brown marmorated stink bug.
When you boil it all down, the problem is pretty basic, he says.
They simply arrived here without their full complement of natural enemies.
And 100 miles away in Newark, Delaware, that is exactly what the U.S. Department of Agriculture is working on. Outside a red door marked quarantine, entomologist Kim Homer and technician Kathy Tatman are suiting up.
If there were an insect that were to be loose in quarantine, which it's not supposed to be, it would stay on the outside of the quarantine suit rather than getting into our hair or inside our shirt, so we wouldn't be bringing it back outside again.
Behind this door are a myriad of foreign insects being evaluated to see if they can fight invasive foreign pests that have gone wild in North America.
So she has to use this special electronic key to go in.
If it allows me to open.
Well, actually, all we see is a tiny concrete room with a hugely heavy door, and then another tiny concrete room.
How many of these chambers are there?
There's one more.
Yeah, three little anterooms.
And finally, we reach a series of dark, glowing red corridors.
See that all the light is red to minimize insect flight movement, because most insects can't see red. This looks like a dark room to them.
Everything is designed to prevent escape.
All of the air and the water coming into and out of quarantine is filtered. All the air goes through HEPA filters, which will keep anything larger than a virus from passing through.
Tatman pulls out tray after tray of little vials and petri dishes from modules whose temperature, light, and humidity are precisely controlled.
This is an insect growth chamber.
Inside the little vials, rafts of tiny, pearly, green orbs sit on leaves. They're stink bug eggs. And there's something else in there. Tiny black dots are zipping around in the jars. Parasitoid Trisulcus wasps from China, Japan, and Korea. Just 2 millimeters long, they don't look like much more than gnats. They don't bite or sting, and they feed on nectar. But in Asia, they are the natural nemesis of the brown marmorated stink bug.
These small wasps will deposit their eggs inside the stink bug eggs. And then the parasite egg hatches, and its immature stage feeds on the inside of the stink bug egg.
In a few weeks, out pops a new wasp and no stink bug. Homer says these wasps are extremely specialized evolutionarily.
If they can't find stink bug eggs to lay their own eggs in, they'll die. They can't survive on anything else.
But there are almost 300 types of stink bug in the U.S., and a lot of them are helpful because they eat other pests. So Homer needs to know, would these wasps ever go after other stink bugs? What about stink bugs that are really, really closely related to the brown marmorated stink bug? What if they were locked in a jar with no other option? Well, Homer will test exactly that, putting the wasps with different stink bug species to see what happens.
If we've chosen wisely, we have a good picture of the specificity of the wasps. If they won't attack any of the close relatives, they will not be as likely to attack any of the more distant ones.
It'll take 3 years before he's satisfied that the wasps don't pose a risk. Homer points to examples where this has worked before. Gypsy moths were controlled by an introduced fungus. White flies in California were cut down by other parasitic wasps. Back at Catoctin Mountain Orchard, Bob Black can't wait.
Using the wasp hopefully will be our answer. I mean, we've had other things, drought, we have other issues, but this insect is one of the toughest things that we're going to have to work on.
Until then, 7 states are asking the EPA to relax pesticide regulations. Researchers are looking at pheromones, traps, and naturally repellent landscape plants, none of which are considered fully effective. I'm Sabri Benishour.
Protecting your crops from stink bugs is, of course, only part of the challenge. Once you address that challenge, then you have to figure out how to get your crops onto people's plates. And here in the district, we have more than a few neighborhoods where you'd be hard-pressed to find fresh fruit and vegetables for sale. But as Mark Adams reports, a local nonprofit has created a sort of caravan to cross those food deserts and bring fresh produce directly to the people.
Canned corn, canned peaches. My favorite is canned green beans. This one actually is the no salt added, mostly because I've eaten all the ones with the salt.
Jana Baldwin's kitchen is stuffed with canned foods and frozen vegetables she bought with her food stamps. They are the only things that will keep. Besides a few apples in the fridge, there is hardly any fresh produce to be seen.
I will just eat whatever it is that I have in the house. So if that's just, you know, canned beans and a hot dog, that's fine. I mean, I'm not starving, but it would be better to have, you know, all of the food groups that are necessary to be more healthy.
And why doesn't this LaDroit Park resident just go down to the local grocery store?
There's none. Zero, nothing in LaDroit Park proper.
Baldwin lives in one of the district's food deserts, defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as a neighborhood more than a mile away from a large grocery store.
In D.C., it's a very big issue.
Alexander Ashbrook, director of the nonprofit organization D.C. Hunger Solutions, works to find local answers to a national problem. She says residents in food deserts have too little access to healthy food and all too much access to things like chips and soda.
When people don't have access to healthy foods such as fruits and vegetables, which are typical needs in a food desert, you can see spikes in diet-related illnesses such as diabetes, heart-related disease, nutrition-fueled cancers, and obesity.
But supporters of local agriculture say that doesn't have to be a community's fate. Here in Southwest D.C., live jazz entertains shoppers at the launch of a new farmer's market.
I've got two different kinds. So this is your more sort of traditional kale. It's delicious.
It's an event put on by Arcadia Foods, a small organization that works to bring fresh produce from fields of local farms to the dinner plates of D.C. residents. The founder, Mike Babin, now has his sights set on the food deserts of D.C. by putting farmers markets like this one on wheels.
We've got a bus, and we're calling the mobile market, that is going to be outfitted as a farmer's market. It's going to roll into these communities and set up shop for one day a week to just provide that food to those communities.
The bus isn't much to look at, just your average yellow school bus. But Babin has plans to retrofit it soon to carry some 50 crates of fresh produce like lettuce, kale, carrots, and asparagus.
All right, let me get the door here.
And it won't just carry vegetables. The plan is to also make the bus run on them. Vegetable oil, that is, with a blend of diesel. You could call it a very green yellow school bus.
It's great to have this kind of a vehicle rolling around town, bringing great local food into communities that need it.
Babin is hoping to sell the food at a reduced price by securing grants and donations. But with many people already accustomed to the packaged and canned food diets, there's no guarantee Babin's potential customers will bite.
How confident are you that people will actually buy your product once this hits the road?
Yeah. Well, I'm confident that they will eventually, but I'm realistic, I think, and we're realistic about whether that will happen immediately.
Babin says they hope to whip up interest by meeting with community leaders and making educational visits to schools. The first planned stop will be in Jana Baldwin's neighborhood of LaDroit Park, where community leader Keenan Dunson says demand is high for fresh fruits and vegetables.
I believe that there is an interest and that people, when shown what can come out of the ground and what can go onto their plate, will be interested and have been interested.
Just a block down the road, Baldwin is intrigued by the mobile market idea, but still has a pinch of skepticism.
I think many communities may feel that it's only for a specific population, and so it would have to definitely be marketed in a way that was inclusive to all communities.
Babin's plan is one of many that have cropped up to address food deserts in D.C., but most only serve as a short-term fix. Babin says getting grocery stores with affordable produce into more low-income neighborhoods is the ultimate goal. Until then, people like Baldwin will have to do anything they can to stock their kitchen with food.
You know, I've been grateful for the friends that have been able to give me a ride or what have you. But, I mean, there's times when you just buck up and you just carry your groceries. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, you got to eat.
And knowing others in her neighborhood are less well off, Baldwin counts herself as one of the lucky ones. I'm Mark Adams.
You can find a link to an interactive map of food deserts here and around the country on our website, metroconnection.org. Now, no one would really call the school lunchroom a food desert. After all, school cafeterias have long been known for serving up plenty of food. Tater tots, fried chicken, chocolate milk. But that, say many activists, is exactly the problem. These go-to menu items aren't exactly, well, what you'd call nutritious. So D.C. public school officials say they're bidding adieu to such high-calorie, low-nutrition fare. Kavitha Cardoza visited one D.C. school to check out the cafeteria menu and see if she could find the answer to an age-old question. How do you get school kids to eat healthier, more nutritious food?
It's snack time at Powell Elementary School in Northwest D.C. Students can pick any one fruit and one vegetable from a platter that includes red peppers, orange cantaloupe, and green sugar snap peas.
How you doing, sir?
I have grape and orange.
Has to be one vegetable. You have a fruit and one vegetable.
Broccoli.
Broccoli? Okay. You enjoy that, young man.
Different colors can help entice children to try something new. Some of them have never seen foods such as strawberry or squash. 9-year-old Stephen Alvarez tastes grapefruit for the first time.
This is my new favorite fruit. My friends, sometimes they don't try because it looks gross. They only like things that they have tried before.
The goal of such tastings is also to teach children about how eating healthily can improve their memory and build strong bones. But 7-year-old Devisha Hockaday had an entirely different reason when she chose carrots.
One of my aunts, when they were little, they were told that when they eat carrots, their eyes will look beautiful, and when she grew up, they did.
There's a lot more emphasis on fruits and veggies in DC schools because of a law called the Healthy Schools Act, which the City Council passed in May 2010. Council member Mary Che championed the act as a way to reach more than 70,000 students in the public school system.
If they're going to be having meals in school, we're responsible for them. I think it's so wrong-headed to think that we should just allow them to eat food that's bad for them.
DCPS is now serving 2 million more meals this year compared to last year because of expanded breakfast and supper programs. Schools are encouraged to serve vegetarian options, and students must have access to cold, filtered water. The district is one of the few cities in the country to fund the changes through a soda tax that generates $6 million. Ed Bruski, a blogger who's written extensively about DC school meals, says change was sorely needed.
Kids were getting 15 or 16 teaspoons worth of sugar in breakfast. One lunch consisted of a bag of Sun chips, potato wedges, and strawberry milk. That qualified as a lunch in DC schools.
Jeff Mills heads food and nutrition programs for DCPS. He's responsible for 60,000 meals served every day at more than 120 schools. Mills says students are now served more whole grains, low or non-fat milk, and a different fruit and vegetable each day.
No flavored milk. There's no fried foods on the menu at all. We don't have any chicken nuggets. No french fries.
Bruski calls the changes dramatic, but says the nutritional standards don't go far enough. Bruski wants to see less sugar, fewer potatoes, and less salt, and much more emphasis on educating children about what they're being served and why.
It's not at all a kid-friendly program. It's a government program with standards that are designed by a committee and rules and regulations that are aimed at adults, and the kids are the caboose. They're the last consideration. You know, will they eat this food?
Mills agrees getting children to eat the healthy food is challenging. He sampled approximately 300 items to see which ones would work in schools. Mills says baked fish was an unexpected hit, so were fresh salads and barbecue chicken. But there was one disaster dish.
Rock and Moroccan stew. You know, we're challenged with adding more beans and more lentils to the menu, but the feedback that we got at the beginning of the year was anything with beans, the kids didn't like.
What is it? I've never heard of.
Rock and Moroccan stew, and you probably never will again.
Advocates say improving the quality of food in schools is critical, especially as so many students, approximately 10,000, now eat all 3 meals in school. Mill says implementing the law wasn't just changing the menu or increasing the number of meals. It was also a lot of behind-the-scenes work, including more staff training.
Storage in terms of needing to convert freezers to refrigerators, because we have much less frozen food than we ever had before. And we have more deliveries now because we have more fresh produce coming in.
Mills plans to expand the number of salad bars in schools and buy more foods from local farmers. It's too early to tell whether the healthier foods are making a difference in terms of children's health, but DCPS is now tracking students' height and weight to see whether they're shedding pounds. Those results should be available sometime next year. I'm Kavita Cardoza.
Time for another break, but when we get back, trying to make a buck out on the Chesapeake Bay.
I think it's the beginning of the end, really. It's nothing for people to do on the water.
Plus, a popular American toaster pastry goes local and homemade.
The Pop-Tart is a small pie, really. I mean, that's all it is.
That and more in just a minute on Metro Connection, here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today we're chowing down on some culinary classics as we bring you our favorite stories about one of our favorite subjects, food. And one of the district's regular food rituals is a celebration of cherries, or to be more accurate, cherry blossoms. Each year, the National Cherry Blossom Festival blooms for several weeks in late March and early April. And to pay tribute to those iconic pink and white blossoms, many restaurants get creative with cherries and cherry blossoms, bringing them straight to your plate, your bowl, even your glass. During the 2011 festival, one restaurant tossed up a cherry blossom salad with jumbo shrimp and cherry balsamic. Another served primavera cherry soup. And yet another whipped up homemade cherry Pop-Tarts.
So here we are on 8th Street Southeast, standing outside Ted's Bulletin, ready to make some Pop-Tarts.
Yes, Pop-Tarts at, yes, Ted's Bulletin, the Capitol Hill restaurant dedicated to bringing back classic American comfort food. I met up with pastry chef Jack Revelle.
Jack, hi. Hi, pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Who helps crank out 1,000 homemade Pop-Tarts at Ted's each week. Jack says they change the flavors with the season.
We did apple butter in the fall, you know, now we're doing the cherry as the spring starts to arrive. And, you know, we'll do peach later in the summer and we'll do plum, apricot.
So let's talk about how to make these Pop-Tarts. Yeah. I mean, you know, you go to the grocery store and you usually buy your Pop-Tarts, take them out of their little foil wrapper, stick them in the toaster. This is a little more involved, I'm assuming.
Yes, it's all homemade. So we start with kind of a shortbread dough, a mixture of salt and sugar and flour and a little bit of baking powder.
So the dry ingredients are in the bowl.
That's it. And mix that with butter. So here is the butter, which we'll make into about 3 or 4 doughs, which Felipe over here is making. 7.5 pounds of flour. He throws in almost 5 pounds of butter.
That's a lot of butter.
That's a lot of butter.
So vegans beware.
Vegans beware. But it's important to give us a nice flaky crust. The trick is really to keep it very, very cold. We actually freeze it before we put it in. It kind of breaks down as it is beaten in the mixer. Mix that for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And once it's like a pea-sized crumble, add eggs, which are cold, and some vinegar, and a little bit of water to help it all come together. Mix that very quickly until it just comes together. We do it in kind of big amounts here, but even a smaller amount, you can even do it by hand or with a couple of forks. The less you fool with it, the more of a delicate dough you will get at the end. And then it's ready to be portioned, rest for at least an hour, and then we'll start to roll it out. And we have this nice little cutter, so we have a uniform shape.
For those at home, he's cutting in with the rectangular cutter. Let's see if it makes any noise on the radio here. Kind of. So what's the next step after doing the cookie cutter and making all the different rectangles?
The next step over here is egg wash, which we just...
It's gently brushing with your brush there. Mm-hmm.
So this creates kind of the glue for our Pop-Tart. And then we also have our cherry filling.
Now what's in this cherry filling, other than cherries, of course?
Some lemon zest, some lemon juice, sugar, vanilla, and we thicken it with some cornstarch and water. Very simple, very plain. We let the cherry shine through.
Can you describe what you're doing with the cherry filling?
Putting the cherry filling into a pastry bag, which has a tip, which will allow me to kind of control the amount I put into each Pop-Tart. But if you're ever doing this at home, you can just use a spoon and spoon it in. So now what I'm doing is, since we have put the egg wash on, I'm sandwiching the two pieces of dough together, and the egg wash will allow it to stick. So now the cherry filling is covered. And now I take a fork, and with the tines, I make little impressions all around the Pop-Tart itself. And this creates the decorative pattern that you remember from the Pop-Tart. And it also helps to bind the two pieces of dough together. And now it's ready for the oven.
How long would you bake one of these, or a batch of these?
If you're doing it at home, at 350 for about 20 to 25 minutes. And you can glaze them. We use a glaze here of cream and sugar. We use sprinkles as well.
What response have you gotten so far from these Pop-Tarts since Ted's open and you've been here?
It's been a wonderful response. The word has spread across the city and people come here just for the Pop-Tarts, and as well as the other things on the menu, of course. But this is definitely a destination item, and we're pretty proud of it. And I think we're starting to get known for it.
Ted's Bulletin isn't quite ready to release the full recipe, but for a little more information on those homemade Pop-Tarts and the National Cherry Blossom Festival, visit our website, metroconnection.org. When it comes to the region's food traditions, it doesn't get much more iconic around these parts than the Chesapeake Bay Blue Crab. Whether served steamed and covered in Old Bay seasoning or mixed into a savory crab cake, these tasty crustaceans are an essential part of good eating for many local residents. But the watermen who catch blue crabs say the number of young people opting to pursue a life on the water is on the decline. and they're worried their way of life may be on the way out. Tara Boyle spent a day out on the bay with some watermen right after Hurricane Irene came roaring up the coast to find out about the ebb and flow of a once flourishing industry.
Bob Evans has a beef with Mother Nature. Captain Bob, as he likes to be called, is a waterman who spends his days catching crabs on the Chesapeake Bay. He loves his job, but when our region gets a hard rain, his profits can take a pounding.
I know fellas yesterday that lost $30,000 worth of crab pots.
The rainwater flows into the bay from local rivers, bringing all sorts of debris with it, in a process Captain Bob refers to as a freshet. It's bad for certain marine species, oysters in particular, and bad for crab pots.
So we have to take our pots and put extra weights and buoys on them so when this freshet of water hits us, it doesn't take our stuff away, too.
That means Captain Bob and his crew, watermen Kyle Snyder and Sergio Leyva, have a long day ahead of them. They're out at Captain Bob's boat in Shadyside, Maryland by 7:30 in the morning on a recent Friday. The skies threaten to bring even more rain as they load crab pots, bushel barrels, and about a dozen rust-colored weights onto the boat. The captain fires up the engine, and it's time to begin another day on the water. He's been at this 6 days a week for more than 40 years in all kinds of weather and water conditions.
Well, I had a progression. I started out in a skip, you know, a 16-foot boat.
Which led to a 22-foot boat.
And then I got a 32-foot boat. And then I bought this boat.
It's sort of a war horse, built for one purpose, to catch a lot of crabs. And you could probably say the same thing about Captain Bob himself, the son of a pharmacist and a teacher who fell in love with the water.
What do we got?
We got 2 dozen jumbos.
As we head out on the bay, he has to shout over the roar of the engines as he shares his family story.
My grandmother was 108 when she passed away. Until the day she died, she always, every time I saw her, she would say, "Have you got a real job yet, or are you still playing around on the water?"
But it becomes clear pretty quickly that this playing around on the water is actually grueling work. The team spends several hours putting weights on empty pots in preparation for the rainwater that's coming with the freshet. And once that's done, it's time to finally begin catching some crabs. The boat idles next to one of Captain Bob's buoys, and the team uses a pulley system to haul the first metal crab pot out of the depths. It's covered in marine plants and gelatinous sea nettles, and it's Sergio's job to haul the pot onto the boat and dump the crabs into a metal bin known as a cull box. The crabs are brownish-gray with those telltale blue claws, and they skitter around frantically as Kyle sorts them according to their size.
Nothing to it. We just come out here and dump the gold out every day.
But there isn't as much gold in the bay as there used to be. Captain Bob says he grosses about $800 a day.
If I gross $800 a day, I make $200.
Not enough to get rich, but enough to pay the bills and put his daughters through college. Still, he's worried this way of life may be disappearing. The evidence of it, he says, can be seen in his own community of Shadyside.
If you look around here now, it's a half a dozen watermen. There used to be 400 workboats tied up here.
And he's particularly concerned about the future of younger watermen, such as Kyle and Sergio. These men will have lots to worry about, from hurricanes to pollution to political battles over the bay.
Well, I think it's the beginning of the end, really, unless there's some things change. Certain things will do well, but, you know, we have no clams, no oysters. The striped bass fishery is at a point where it's regulated down to a part-time fishery. It's nothing for people to do on the water.
Nothing, that is, except continue the hunt for the bay's most iconic species, the Maryland blue crab, and hope it will continue to provide a living for the next generation of watermen. I'm Tara Boyle.
We wrap up today's Culinary Classics show with an iconic sound of summer. The music of the neighborhood ice cream truck as it winds its way through the streets of our nation's capital. The driver of this particular truck is Usman Lijalo, who emigrated from Sierra Leone in the 1980s. Lee's truck is plastered with advertisements for frozen treats, but Uncle Lee, as he's known, is much more than an ice cream man to the residents he serves in Northeast and Southeast D.C. For these Washingtonians, Lee's truck is a one-stop shop for snacks, chips, hot dogs. On any given summer day, you can see him giving free candy to his younger customers, some of whom have little money for treats. But here's the thing, beyond the sweets and treats, Lee often serves up something else, a healthy helping of advice. Lauren Landau climbed aboard Lee's truck and sent back this audio postcard.
My name is Usman Lee Jallo. I am one of the senior vendors here. I cover Northeast Washington and Southeast. Our first stop will be in Deanwood. That's in Northeast Washington.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
How you doing?
Good.
Very good. Would you like some food, as you said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How much would you like? $1 worth?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. I give out a lot of things. I've been giving out stuff since I was a kid. I remember that, as far as I remember. I remember one time I had one uniform to go to school. I gave it to somebody to go to school. I said, you go to school. My brother came home and asked me, he said, what's wrong with you? Why you didn't go to school? I said, I gave my uniform to this boy. He don't have no clothes. My brother took me to the shop, bought me a new one. I said, okay, let's go to school. Because we can afford it. They can't. You know, I couldn't go to my parents. I said, give me something. I gave this guy. So I gave him what I had. Hi. How you doing?
Crybaby.
Yes, let me see what you got here. Oh, boy. Crybaby costs $2, and this young man has $1. So what he's going to get is a junior bomb pop, and he will get a free candy. Yeah. Every time you buy a small bomb pop, you get a free candy. They are so happy. Look at their faces. They're going to go in there and not tell everybody, he's giving out candy. Let's go out there.
It's not just an ice cream truck. This is the community ice cream truck. Mr. Lee, one of the nicest guys you ever want to meet. You know, if you're short, he'll let you go. You can give it to him later on or whatever. That's right.
Can I have a water?
Yes, sure, sure.
Can I pay you next week?
Yeah, okay. With me and this area here, it's 40% ice cream man. For this particular area, you have to sell more of the juices, the hot dogs, and your chips.
I have a 15-year-old son. So when he don't have any money, Mr. Lee usually give him his stuff free. You know, and then I come in, I pay him. Yeah. So you don't find ice cream men to do that. That's special.
Yeah, in the suburbs, they tell you they don't want no chips, no snacks, no candies, no sodas. They just want ice cream because it's a treat. But down here, it's luxury. Ice cream is considered luxury. If it's too hot, don't go out there. If it's raining, don't go out there. But over here, if it's snowing, you can come out. They will buy.
He's very well known in this area. Every day, everybody wait for his truck. If another truck pull up now, they're not going to go to it. They're going to go to Mr. Lee.
It's not really something that I can say I'm proud of doing. I just think it's something that I am supposed to do to help the kids, help people, talk to them, not just even giving them food. I even give them advices.
Everybody around here knows him. He called me Uncle Mike. I call him Uncle Lee. That's my buddy. I describe his role as being a mentor to the youngins, to the young guys, the younger generation, you know, letting them know when they're doing wrong and putting them on the right path to do the right things in life so that they can prosper, get out and go to school, get their education, graduate and everything, so when they get out of school, they can get a good job, possibly go to college or whatever. And that's what he talks to them about.
Yeah, some come in here, we sit down like a family and we talk. You have couples that get into situations and they come in here and they want me to talk to them. So I give my advice. I just give you a little opinion, and I tell you, go out there and work with it. If it works well, you're lucky. Not just the ice cream man, but the counselor, I guess.
To see pictures of Lee at work in his ice cream truck, head to our website, metroconnection.org.
I'll stop the world and melt with you. You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time. And there's nothing you and I won't do. I'll stop the world and meld with you.
¶¶ And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Kavitha Cardoza, Sabri Benashour, Tara Boyle, Emily Friedman, and Lauren Landau, along with reporter Mark Adams. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website. That's metroconnection.org. And while you're there, you can find us on Twitter. You can join us on Facebook. You can listen to individual Metro Connection stories. And if you'd like to listen to the whole show, you can click the podcast link up at the top of the page. We hope you can join us next week when we bring you a bunch of exciting stories and interviews about people and places in the DC region. But in the meantime, have a great week, and remember, when it comes to those ghost peppers, taster beware.
So she took another bite, and she's sweating, and her eyes are all watered up, and nose is running, and it's like, oh.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.